Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Renee Denfeldt, author of the new novel Sleeping Giants from HarperCollins. Renee's previous novels include The Butterfly Girl and The Child Finder, which feature private investigator Naomi Cottle, a.k.a. The Child Finder. Her debut novel, The Enchanted, earned the prestigious French Prix Award and an ALA Medal for Excellence in Fiction. She's also published in The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The Philadelphia Inquirer, and The New York Times named her a 2017 Hero of the Year. Renee lives here in Portland and is the proud mom of three children, now adults, adopted from the foster program. In the words of Rebecca Solnit, Renee Denfeldt keeps writing books I have to read in one sitting because I can't stop. Like her previous books, Sleeping Giants has the pace and excitement of a thriller, but the compassion and generosity that can otherwise seem so antithetical to the genre as it enters into the lives of an adopted and an institutionalized child, and those of other people who are somehow stranded, bereft, or disconnected. Please join us for our conversation with Renee, which is already in progress. Renee, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios.
Thank you for having me.
It's a return. We did the interview for The Butterfly Girl 2019, so I'm really happy
and
to see
KBOO
you again.
And KBOO actually goes way back in my memories. I think actually my first experience at KBOO, I was maybe 12 or 13 and had developed an interest in punk music. And
yes, we talked about that. You were big on the punk scene. You were in a band, weren't you?
I was in a couple bands, and that was when I was 15, 16. But before that, I used to tune into a late night punk show, I think Pat Baum. Yeah, I remember laying on my bed and listening to KBOO radio because it was the only place that you could hear any alternative music.
The only music we play.
So this place goes back in my memories, and it's been such a big part of the community. So thank you.
Renee, in the intro, I read Rebecca Solnit's kind words on your new book, Sleeping Giants, which she says, quote, enters into the lives of people who are somewhat stranded, bereft, or disconnected. Many of your characters fit that description, and your understanding and compassion for them comes from your personal experience, including those punk days, but even before that, when you were homeless.
Yeah, absolutely. I come from a pretty difficult background, which I've talked about before. A lot of poverty. I ended up being homeless when I was a young teenager. I actually got off the streets largely in part to libraries, where I spent all my time. I spent pretty much every day in the downtown public library and the punk community, actually, which was a very welcoming community, took me in. Ended up being a singer for some different punk bands here in town.
Do you remember some of the names?
Oh, yeah.
That we can say on the radio.
I think so. You know, when I was 15, 16, I was a singer for a hardcore punk band called Sin Hipster. And I think one of our claims to fame was opening up for Black Flag.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. And then later in my early 20s, I sang for a punk band called Caustic Soda.
I think I've heard of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, some extremely gifted musicians. You know, I always felt as a singer that I couldn't, hold a candle to the people that, I played with. I just played with just some amazing musicians. And we played a lot of shows around town, places like the Blue Gallery.
Probably La Luna, which used to be just a block or two from KBOO.
I don't know if we ever... We played a lot of shows at Satyricon. Opened for Nirvana and bands like that. So, yeah, it was just a great community, took me in. So I've always, I think, I tend to write about, they say write what you know, and I write about what I know. I don't have a conventional background. I come from a place of a lot of trauma, a background of, kind of being a misfit. And and also then I ended up going into careers where I help people. I'm a foster and adoptive mother, and I work in criminal justice now. So I think I just kind of you know, I resonate with people that come from the margins. And that's what I end up writing about.
And as we'll get into, you were able to heal yourself. Some people are get broken. And you very defiantly said that I'm not broken. It was the other people who were broken, and you recovered from that, or you were able to escape from it.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's very important to frame, you know, I think trauma really damages and hurts us. But I think very early on, I was able to identify when I was the problem. And that actually touches upon something interesting about this story. As I was writing Sleeping Giants, was really wanting to examine the harm that's committed by everyday people, which is kind of a major theme that kind of runs through the book. You know, because I think we talk a lot in our culture about the harm that's committed by people that are outliers. You know, and that's actually true in a lot of fiction as well. Usually you have a bad guy that's just an outright bad guy.
Right.
You know, you have the sociopath that's running around eating people's livers for lunch. Or, you know, somebody that's like the evil corporation. Or you have the bad guys might be in a drug cartel or gangs. They tend to be bad guys, I think, in a lot of fiction, tend to be outliers or people that are outside the norms of society. But I'm really fascinated with the harms that are committed by people within the norms of society. And I think a lot of people are really intrigued by that, too. And we're, you know, at our place in history, it's something that we really, I think, need to examine. If you look back, you look at slavery, the Holocaust, genocides, you know, mental health treatments, lobotomies. You can just go on and on with these examples of harmful, terrible things that everyday people have committed or they've been complicit in.
But done by people who think they're doing the right thing in some strange, perverted way.
Yeah. And actually, if you look at the history of mankind and all of the harms that get committed, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that some of the worst harms are committed by these people that think they're doing the right thing.
And there's certainly a character at the center of the book, who thinks she's doing the right thing.
Exactly. And that's kind of the central, I think, kind of theme of Sleeping Giants. And so you have the capacity of people to commit harm in the name of good. And it kind of intersects in this story with the people that are on the margins, the people that are helpless and powerless.
There's nobody they can go to. Nobody will believe them.
Exactly. And when those two things come together, as I think we see a lot in our society, you have the intersection for some really profound trauma to occur.
Yeah, I wanted to start talking about the book now. From our last interview, you mentioned that you have started several of your books and you were inspired by these imaginary voices you heard and people you actually saw, imaginary people, but they were there as real as anybody for you. With A Child Finder, it was a little girl who started talking to you, I think, while you were walking through the snow in Portland. For your first novel, The Enchanted, and we talked about this too, it was an older man sitting in the front passenger seat of your car with his bare feet up on the dashboard. I mean, you actually saw everything there. I really wondered, did the new book have a similar origin? Did one of the characters appear to you and start talking with you?
Yes and no. You know, all my books, I think, start with that kind of voice, with somebody that's going to tell me a story. And this one, the opening scenes of Sleeping Giants, in the very beginning, there's a scene of a little boy who is charging across the hard-packed sands of an Oregon beach, and he's running towards this very tumultuous, dangerous ocean. That was the scene that I saw first. And in this case, I mean, this scene kind of just came to me and it just kind of hit me like, you know, that gust of cold ocean wind. And at that time, I was actually down in Manzanita, which is one of my favorite beaches to go to, having kind of a self-care day. And I was walking along the beach and I just saw this, you know, this image of this little boy charging across the sands into this ocean. And I knew that was going to be the genesis of a story.
And it's actually the first few pages of the book.
Yeah, exactly. And then it becomes the question of like, who is that little boy and why is he running into the ocean, which is not safe? You know, where did he come from? What happened to him? And so the story just kind of unfolded from there.
But that's amazing. It starts like that. It's kind of like somebody out there wants you to tell these stories.
Yeah, it feels like
they're
that.
They're giving you a little nudge.
Yeah, it feels like that. I think that's kind of the beautiful portal of storytelling, you know, kind of a fiction in general is... Somebody told me recently, I'm going to mutilate this quote, but Tom Spounbauer...
Dangerous Writers.
Yeah. He apparently has a saying that something like, you know, fiction is the lie that tells the truth. And I'm sure I probably got that wrong. But, you know, I think it's... That's what can happen when we tell these stories is there, you know, it's like a portal into somebody else's life. And in my case, I really want to tell these stories that are portals into people's lives that you don't often hear about. You know, if you asked me to write a story that was set in the Hamptons, I would really struggle. I would have no clue.
These very affluent characters who have nothing in the world to worry about.
Yeah. And I'm sure they probably do have their own interior, but I don't understand that world, and that's okay. But I can use my experiences and the things I do understand to tell these stories that kind of help put readers inside the lives of, I think, characters that we often don't hear about.
Now, the main character in the book is Amanda Dufresne, mm-hmm. and her brother is the boy you saw running into the surf, and we wonder what happened to him. His name is Dennis. They were separated after their mother died of alcoholism. Amanda was adopted into foster care. Mm-hmm. Her parents are loving parents, both Reed professors, and mm-hmm. you say they listen to NPR. So I think I know those people. But Dennis was sent to an institution on the Oregon coast, Brightwood, which is described as a home for troubled boys. What a loaded phrase. He was presumed drowned at the age of 9, and it was called an accident by authorities. Though his body was never found, and from the first few pages of the book, it appears to be a suicide. He ran into the ocean. Now, in our last interview for The Butterfly Girl, we mentioned you lost your older brother mm-hmm. to suicide. And I talked about I've lost two friends over the years to suicide and how that makes you feel guilty, mm-hmm. Just confused. You don't know why it happened. Did that influence Amanda and her quest at all and this relationship, Amanda and her missing brother?
Yeah, that's such an astute question. Thank you. I don't know if anybody listening, you can't see us talking, but I'm sure Ken just saw my eyes kind of, you know, light up with an emotion because my older brother.
I think I feel the same way.
Yeah. My older brother's name was Dennis.
Ah.
So absolutely. And I think it's the grief that never ends. It really is. And I don't want to get all teary-eyed in the interview, but I think... You know, there's some losses that just create these holes in our lives. And, you know, it's the mystery of it.
Yes. Could I have done more?
Yeah.
How come I didn't know?
Yeah. Did I fail?
Exactly. You know? Yeah.
And actually, I think that teases out something that kind of goes to what I was saying before is like we live in a time like all times where people can commit all this harm in the name of good. And I think it's also... a time, I don't know if this is unprecedented or not, where there's a lot of defensiveness. People have a very hard time in our culture admitting when they're wrong. And rather than admit, hey, we were wrong, let's fix our mistake, I think we live in a culture where people double down and they don't want to admit, hey, we were wrong about mass incarceration, let's fix our mistake. Or we were wrong about this war, let's fix our mistake, or whatever the issue is. It's just very hard for people in our culture to admit that and to atone and make amends. And so we live in this society where it's just hard to admit the harms that we commit. And I think for me, suicide and the loss that comes from suicide is kind of a window into that unspoken guilt, those unspoken kind of questions we have. Should I have done more? Was it in some ways my fault? Did I make a mistake? And the way that I conduct my life is I don't want to be afraid to ask myself those questions rather than to scurry into a defensiveness, which I think a lot of us in our culture, we're almost encouraged to be defensive.
It's avoidance.
Yeah, it's avoidance.
It might be a truth that we don't want to know.
Yeah, exactly. So you're surrounded by people saying, oh, it's not your fault. You know, you did all you could do, X, Y, and Z. People want to comfort us by telling us that it's never our fault. And in the case of the suicide of my brother, I don't think it was my fault. But could I have done more? yes, I could have done more. And I want to be the kind of person who's strong enough to sit in that place of being able to be wrong and being able to learn from the mistakes I've made. And that's kind of a theme that's threaded throughout Sleeping Giants. Amanda goes in search of finding out. She wants to find out. So she learns about Dennis 20 years after this happened. He charges into the ocean and goes missing. And she learns about him, and she comes down to the Oregon coast, and she wants to find out what happened to my brother Dennis. And in the process of kind of uncovering this, she actually finds a lot of stuff that was very bad. You know, so it turns into a mystery slash thriller. We were having a conversation about genres and labels, but, you know, so she's kind of finding out this mystery. And as a result, instead of people admitting that they're wrong, they start doubling down. And she gets in more danger.
Yeah, and she's an amateur, really, at investigating mysteries. So she's unlike your previous character, Naomi Cottle, mm-hmm. who's the main character in both The Child Finder and The Butterfly Girl. She was a licensed investigator, and her job was actually finding missing children. Amanda doesn't really know much about how to be an investigator, like you were. You were chief investigator at a public defender's office. And you were working cases that often involved death row inmates, victims of rape, trafficking. Mm-hmm. So when writing these mysteries and solving them in the novels, your characters use, I think, techniques that you would use. I know in previous interviews you've mentioned kind of the absurdity of having like a psychic mm-hmm. investigator or investigator going to a psychic and the psychic leading them exactly to the murder or how it occurred. So it must mirror some of your experiences mm-hmm. as a licensed professional investigator.
Yeah, I don't have to do a lot of research.
not there, but not, in other parts of the book,
I have to do plenty of research. Yeah, and actually, I was really pleased that she's an ordinary person, and she's wrestling, you know, what happened with my brother, and she wants to find out. And actually, I really like this part of the book, is she's not some sort of super genius detective, or she's not hard-boiled. She doesn't fit any of the stereotypes. She is somebody who actually has her own challenges.
Yeah, she's neurodivergent. It turns out they can't really diagnose what's wrong with her, but they mm-hmm. figure she's a little slow. She's bad at math.
Yeah.
But she's intelligent, as the reader can tell.
Yeah, exactly. And I wanted that part of, you know, to kind of creep up on people, because it's not a central part. You know, she, more than anything, she's somebody who just really wants to know the truth, which I think just about any woman can tell you can get us in a lot of trouble.
Yes.
So, and that's kind of her quest. So, you know, I kind of wanted this story to be these ordinary people in some ways, you know, flawed people who can commit harm themselves, who aren't always perfect, and they're all trying to figure out what happened. And the bad guy in the book, too, isn't your conventional bad guy. It's actually somebody who thinks they're doing the right thing.
Yes, there's at least two or three bad guys in there who feel that way. Now, Amanda's helped, at least, as an amateur. She fortunately meets a retired Portland police officer, Larry Palmer, who's living on the coast. And we should mention this town, Eagle Cove, mm-hmm. which is not Manzanita.
No.
It's kind of run down, isolated, though somewhere between Manzanita and Seaside and Cannon mm-hmm. Beach, I think, based on where they go in the book, the location. And we mentioned the two time frames. You did, we're present day, where Amanda and Larry are trying to find out what happened to Dennis, and then 20 years previously when Dennis ran into the ocean and was presumed drowned. We see these events at Brightwood 20 years before, when Dennis was incarcerated there, and provides a lot of background for us and gives the reader direct experience with events and characters that Amanda is only learning about as she investigates as the book goes on. So we know things that Amanda hasn't discovered yet. I was wondering, Renee, what were your reasons for going with that structure? And did you have that going in the initial draft, those alternating chapters, those two mm-hmm. time frames?
You know, initially, I didn't know I was going to do that. I actually realized recently in all my books, I tend to to do a kind of a shifting point of view or shifting time frames. They all tend to either have an alternating character point of view.
Yes, it's a third person. Is it called direct? Third person direct point of view?
It's third person, but you're
in the head of the character.
Yeah, it's a very close third person where you get in these characters' heads. And I'm not sure, you know, I think I end up doing that because it's, I feel really drawn to hearing multiple perspectives, you know, and I wanted to really, I didn't want Dennis to be this kind of picture on the wall. I didn't want him to be an afterthought. I wanted, there's a lot of children that grow up in these kind of facilities. And if you get me started, I'll talk a lot about that. But there's, you know, we have like 500,000 kids in foster care in our country, and they are the vanished. They are the kids that people just, they just kind of, they're, it's like, it's a lot like mass incarceration, where we just disappear people into a system. And they don't really exist, I think, for a lot of people. And interestingly enough, it's one of those things where confidentiality laws, which are there to kind of protect people, end up hiding and obscuring a lot of terrible wrongs.
Which makes it much harder for Amanda and Larry to solve the mystery in the book.
Exactly.
And I think at one point you have a social worker quote that there's 20,000 missing kids from foster care.
Yeah.
And nobody knows where they are.
And that's a true figure. I think the number is at least 18,000 children unaccounted for. And literally, like, people do not know where these children are. Some of them might have run away from foster care and they disappear. Other ones literally, like, kind of get disappeared in the system. Somebody loses the case file. Something happens. And because of the
confidence. Or there's a cover-up.
And there's been cases where I remember one where a little four-year-old girl was found. This is a terrible story for anybody that's listening. And I won't go into details, but she was a four-year-old girl was found deceased, and the police couldn't even identify who she was.
And they weren't allowed to look at her records.
And actually, I think after some time, they finally figured out that she had gone missing years before, like several years before, from foster care, and there hadn't even been a missing person report. So you have a system where, because of state lines and all these other issues, where children can kind of literally disappear. And it's something I kind of, I wanted to explore in the book, as well as how captive children can be to all the terrible things that can go wrong. And all these things are kind of hidden behind the cloak of confidentiality.
Now, I want to get back to the setting of the book. We talked about the coastal community in Oregon, Eagle Cove, a fictional town. But part of the book also takes place in Arizona, in a fictional town that gives the book its title, Sleeping Giant. It actually exists. There's something called the Sleeping Giant there. It's an intaglio, I looked it up, carved into the desert floor hundreds of years ago. They're also called geoglyphs. I've heard of one famous one, the Nazca Lines in Peru. In your book, this intaglio is a human figure, and as one of the characters, Amanda, I think, notes, an anatomically correct one. How did you find out about these intaglios, these sleeping giants, and why did you use this in the story?
I think that's one of the really cool things about being a writer is you never know. I mean, there's all these things kind of in your mind, and you never know when they're going to pop up or come forward. So, as you mentioned, I used to be the chief investigator for a public defense firm. And for many years, I still do this. I'm a licensed investigator in the state of Oregon, and I work a variety of cases. I've done death row exonerations. I've worked, lately I've been working juvenile cases.
I think there's fewer executions now on death row. So
yeah, exactly.
That's good for humanity, but bad for business.
Oh, there's plenty of business.
Yeah, plenty of business and other.
With mass incarceration, there's a lot, you know, and actually something that's a sideline issue, but there's a lot of people that are falsely convicted that aren't on death row. And they're actually less likely to get help because if you're on death row, you at least get appeals. If you're falsely convicted of an offense like, say, robbery or regular murder and you're convicted, it's very hard to get an investigator. It's very hard to get things reexamined. But anyhow, I still do this work and I love it. And some years ago, I was actually traveling on a case, a death row case, and I was down on the border between California and Arizona. And I was
near Blythe, California.
Near right? Blythe. I was actually staying in Blythe, California, uh-huh. because there is a prison down there. And I had to go interview somebody in the prison that's by Blythe, California. If you want an interesting experience, go stay in Blythe, California. And it was one of these little hotels where, you know, if you're working indigent defense, you get a per diem rate for what you can spend on your hotel. And it's always something terrible like $90. And so you're trying to find a hotel in Blythe, California for $90. And I'm sorry to anybody listening that's familiar with Blythe. I'm sure there's great things about Blythe. But I went to this hotel and I remember like I flipped the mattress, which you learn to do. To see if there's bed bugs, and you're like, oh, I can't. I think I slept that night in my car.
you must have found a few.
Yeah. So anyhow, I was driving down to the prison down in Blythe, California, and I remember it's way out in the desert, and it's way out in the desert to the point where like every 10 or so miles you pass a water jug that's sitting on the side of the road in case somebody breaks down.
And you use that detail in the book.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was going out to the prison and I remember seeing like some sign for, you know,
the sleeping giant.
Yeah. The sleeping giants. And I took a detour and saw it. And for some reason that popped up in this book and the detail came up. And for me, actually, you know, there's real sleeping giants in the book, and I touch upon what they are. But to me, they became very symbolic for what we're talking about, which is how good people can commit harm, or everyday people can commit harm in the name of good. And I really wanted to examine what I consider the sleeping giants of the situation, which is those secret hidden motivations that we all have.
Oh, what a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah. So it became my, and it's very, you know, like all my work, this is stuff that I'm writing and I realize it kind of later as I'm going, but it became the metaphor for me. It's like, what are those secret motivations behind people when they do these things in the name of good? What is it really about? Because I think it's usually not about what we think it's about. It's usually not about what we say it's about. There's something else that's percolating under the surface for a lot of these harms. And I really wanted to kind of dig at it. Like, what is it really about?
Yeah, when I looked it up, I found that historians and archaeologists are unsure of the origins of the sleeping giants. I'm sure there's a lot of speculation. But in the book, Amanda actually questions an historian there at the site, and she's told that there's a myth, and I'm quoting from the book, if the sleeping giants are awakened, they will take revenge on all of us. Amanda asks, what for? Mm-hmm. And the historian replies, those crimes, my friend, are no longer remembered. So I love the way you tie that in to mm-hmm. the events of the book. There's an ominous tone to that.
Yeah. And it is the, you know, maybe it's because of the defensiveness or, you know, whatever. But, you know, I think there's so many crimes that are no longer remembered. And particularly when you have populations like kids in foster care. And, you know, how we can't learn from something that we don't recall.
Or is covered up.
We can't learn. Or if we don't think it's important enough. You know, I think we all have the capacity to be brave enough to look at ourselves and to ask, you know, what did we do here?
Now, after this home for troubled boys on mm-hmm. the Oregon coast closes, Brightwood, there's an old sign that Amanda and Larry find that still stands outside the building, Brightwood. A place for healing,
yes.
Which is quite ironic. Not much healing happens mm-hmm. there. The director there is named Martha King, and she actually was near the sleeping giant originally at a facility access center and left for mysterious reasons and ended up in Brightwood. She believes strongly in a treatment called holding time, and you describe it very graphically in the book. It's cruel, it's harmful, even fatal. In some cases, I thought you made it up, Renee, but sadly you didn't. You didn't.
No.
It really exists. Can you describe what holding time is, how you found out about it? I mean, it's barbaric.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely barbaric. So actually, I first heard of holding time. I mentioned I'm a longtime foster and adoptive parent. My amazing kids came to me from foster care. And One of my children, when they were younger, had a lot of anger issues, which I think is totally normal. And actually, I think anger and rage can be very healthy. There are ways of saying, hey, what happened to me is not fair. It's not right.
Could be a motivation.
Yeah. It can be a very healthy mechanism. But obviously, if you're acting out in ways that are not healthy, you need help. And so I really wanted to help this child. And I took him to different psychiatrists and counselors and so forth. And one recommended holding time. And that's when I first heard about it. And at that time, holding time was actually very popular in child welfare circles. There were all these newspaper articles about it. It was, I think, even on like morning television shows.
Wow, I'd never heard of it.
Yeah. And it was like, oh, this is the latest cure. And interestingly enough, you know, like a lot of these things, everybody acted as if it was backed by all this science. It wasn't. It was not backed by science. Essentially, what holding time is this profound, it's a form of profound physical and psychological torture. Children are essentially wrapped up in heavy-duty blankets or sheets very tightly. They're suffocated in these things. They're held down and pillows are pressed on them so they can't breathe. The whole idea behind this was to reduce children to a place of complete psychological collapse so that, according to the people that are proponents, these children are then able to have some sort of rebirth. And this whole concept of rebirthing.
Kind of starting from scratch.
Yeah.
It breaks down all their memories, all their defenses, personalities.
Everything.
It's kind of like they're just coming out of the womb again.
Yeah. It was this kind of rebirthing therapy, which has been completely discounted by scientists. It's there's no such things as really being rebirthed. But, you know, according to these proponents, and again, no scientific backing, this was a way to treat children who are labeled disturbed. So nobody knows how many children have experienced this so-called therapy. But it became very popular in treatment centers, and there are actually several clinics that would teach it in Evergreen, Colorado. And I think at least six children have been presumed to have died because of this therapy. Children literally have died while experiencing this form of torture. They've suffocated to death. And the fact that this not only was allowed to happen, but is still allowed to happen. It's still legal. And it's still going on in the country.
It's still
going on. They just use different names nowadays for it. So I think it was my chance to examine, what are the real motivations behind something like this? Why would somebody want to do this to children? How could they possibly override what would seem like your natural revulsion to doing something like this to children? I really want to kind of dig into all those threads. Like, why is this happening?
And the character who performs holding time on the children in Brightwood is Martha. And you have in the book, too, that there's a real-life child psychologist who came up with holding time, whose name is also Martha, Martha G. Welch, and she wrote an influential book on the subject and believed it cured almost everything. The Martha in the book, I think, feels the same way, even using it for some awful gay conversion therapy.
Yeah, which is, yeah, and at that time, and again, it's still used, but the people that are proponents started literally suggesting that this torture be used on children who had ADHD, children who were acting up, children who were disobedient. And of course, their evidence that it supposedly worked was that the children would be compliant afterwards.
Because they were automatons at a certain point, probably.
Yeah.
Huh?
If you've been terrorized and convinced that somebody's basically burying you alive and you're being suffocated to death, you would become pretty compliant too. As I mentioned in the book, it became one of the ways in which it was used for conversion therapy against children that were labeled gay.
And by labeling gay, they're classing them with people of ADHD or acting out, a violent behavior. So automatically the premise is wrong.
Exactly.
That being gay is unnatural and a detriment to society for some reason.
Yeah. And actually, I think a lot of the ways that children get labeled troubled are completely wrong. Honestly, if you're a child and you've experienced a lot of trauma, of course you're going to act out. it's the most natural thing in the world. And to have children come from traumatic situations and to label them troubled and put them in institutions where they receive these draconian treatments. And even if they're not receiving draconian treatments, I don't think an institution is ever a place for a child. So we, you know, instead of helping the children and understanding their backgrounds, you know, we just further traumatize them.
Yeah, I want to contrast that with something you wrote about in the Washington Post. This was several years ago, mm-hmm. about your older son. You adopted him from foster care. And I'm quoting, "When my oldest son, far too large, wanted to climb under my shirt and be carried around like an infant, in my womb I obliged. While he nestled, delighted against my skin, I walked up and down our street, waving to the neighbors who came to expect this game. I'm having a baby, I called, and my lovely neighbor shouted, 'Congrats,' in return. Back at home, my son would jump out of my shirt, 'I'm here,' he always yelled, and I swooped him in the air, covering him with kisses. In this way, he was reborn to me over and over again into a world without hurt. We played this game until he no longer needed it, his brain and heart rewired. What had happened to him before was real, but now so was our love. The abuse he had experienced was not erased. It was unconditionally accepted and loved without measure." So I kept thinking the premise of holding time and what you did is the same, you know, kind of this rebirth. But the treatment itself was very different. One was out of love and care. The other one was out of physical punishment and pain.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've told my kids this a lot over the years is that I tell them I love you for everything that you are. I love you for everything that everything includes what's happened to them. I don't love them despite it. I love them including it.
Well, that's real love.
Yeah, that's real love. And that's, you know, I think that's really key because you can't, you know, and for me, the story of me and my older son jumping from my shirt, that's what that was about. I wasn't trying to erase his history or erase his other mom, erase his love for her. You know, I don't think love is territorial.
And how could you do that?
Yeah,
short of a lobotomy or something? Huh?
No, you can't. So, you know, then that's why draconian kind of treatments never work. They're profoundly shaming. The idea that these children, you know, need to erase or overcome their past. No, we need to accept their past. And I think the irony maybe of love is that you have to really love and accept people just as they are right now. Before they can change. You can't make them change. But if you love and accept people right now as they really are, they might change. In fact, it's a lot easier for them to change.
Yeah, I also wanted to read, you wrote a Modern Love column for the New York Times, and that was in 2017. And this is about your own adopted children. "I had come to believe that the most important therapy is permanence. Children can sense when they're in a temporary home. All my children grew rapidly once settled. More important, they grew emotionally. It's love that feeds the soul, allows us all to flourish." And then later in that same column, you wrote, "By adopting from foster care, I became the mother I had needed and rewrote my own story. I got to have a childhood all over again, the right one, filled with cuddles and perseverance, safety and love. If there is such a thing as a cycle of abuse, I broke it over the wheel of my own desire." So it wasn't only healing for your kids, but you too, Renee, given your background.
Yeah, absolutely.
To love and be loved.
Yeah. And I think we live in such times when there's so much despair. And I think a lot of people feel very helpless, understandably. You know, it's a world that can just feel so hopeless. And I often have people ask me if I'm, you know, if it's hard to do what I do because I'm a single mom, you know, I've raised
well,
all these kids.
It's certainly hard, yes.
Yes, of course it's hard. And I have, you know, the justice work and going to places like Wythe, California.
And you write books.
And I write
beautiful books.
Too. But actually, I'm someone, I often feel very filled with hope. Because I feel like I'm engaged in the process of trying to help. And there's really nothing more hopeful than getting out there and trying to do, you know, to do better. And then with the justice work, for instance, I'm not the only one doing it. I'm part of these legal teams where there's a lot of other people that are trying to change the world for the better.
And that's uplifting to know.
Yeah, it's very uplifting. And it's kind of the antidote to isolation, the antidote to feeling hopeless and helpless. So, yeah, I'm a big believer that we can make a difference, you know, and that truly, you know, loving people as they are, you know, and again, getting back to the theme of the book, I think that part of that, too, is really being willing to examine our own culpability. To, you know, for me, the most profound source of strength is being able to say I'm wrong. And as a parent, I get to do that all the time.
I'm in the same category.
Yeah. Yeah. Like being a mom or dad, it's like you get to, you know, you get practice being wrong.
There's a lot of learning on the job. You know,
exactly.
You got to make mistakes.
Yeah, you do. And like the more you can get in a position to say, hey, you know, I try to do this with my kids too. Like I made a mistake. I was wrong. Can I have a do-over? You know, and the more we can do that, not just as individual people, but I think the more that we can do that as a society, where we can say, you know, hey, that was a mistake. Let's have a do-over. Let's fix it.
Now, we touched on a little before, but while reading the book, I jotted down a note, ask Renee if she believes in evil.
Ah.
And there are characters in your books, including Sleeping Giants, we mentioned Martha, for one, who do evil things. But rather than just calling them monsters, the real kind, you give a little of their story, perhaps explaining, though never excusing, their behavior. In a previous interview, you said, I've worked with people who've done unspeakable things, and there's always a point where I'm connecting with the fact that they were once a 4 or 5-year-old little boy or girl. I've never met anybody that was born a monster. So I guess the answer I think you'll give is that you don't believe evil is inherent. That people are born as demon children and grow up to be demon adults.
Well, it would be convenient to think that, wouldn't it?
Yes, I just sometimes think that myself about people that not that I know personally, but I read about.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly in politics.
I think it's really convenient. And it's also one of the things I think I'm trying to push back at in fiction as well as in other storytelling is I think we tend to other people that commit crimes, we turn them into the conventional bad guy who has no redeeming factors. You know, somebody who's basically outside of society, what I was talking about before, we talk about the outliers, the people who are
just, the serial killers.
The serial killers, the people
no
that,
redeeming qualities.
And interestingly enough, they're not our social responsibility at all. And I think that's a way that we can disconnect from taking responsibility because a lot of times, social harms are socially created. And I think we're just kind of allergic to being able to say, you know what? Well, maybe we have some responsibility here. We don't want to go there.
That's true. If you're just saying evil exists, what can you do about it?
Yeah. Huh? And it's actually, I mean, if you're blaming all crime and violence on evil, actually, I think that's just a very hopeless outlook because then there's nothing you can do. But what if we address something like the role that addiction plays in property crime? Well, if in that case, if a lot of property crime is happening because people are addicted and they want to get money for their fix, well, we can do something about that, or we should do something about that. But those are problems that we can solve. So I think that evil can feel very, in some ways, it feels initially comforting. Because it's a way that we can disallow our own responsibility. We all have a responsibility to each other. I believe this to my core. And by disallowing that responsibility, it might be initially comforting, but in the long run, it doesn't do us any good. And it just makes, I think it just, you know, it makes us feel hopeless, and then we just avoid responsibility. So that's my long answer. My short answer is I've worked hundreds of cases over the years, and I have yet to meet anybody that I think is evil.
And even the characters in the book, like Martha, we get a little bit into her background as a child. And then growing up, her dad was the sheriff, the Sleeping Giant, and he was abusive. So you could kind of understand her behavior.
Yeah.
Again, not condone it, but understand it.
And I think that's so key, because I think in our culture, we're afraid that by understanding, we're somehow condoning. But I think those are two completely separate issues. And Martha's not able to have insight into her character. Martha in the book is kind of going to die on that hill, that she's not going to look at herself. She's never going to have introspection and insight. But I think as human beings and as a society, we can have insight into why we do these things. And that goes back to the theme of Sleeping Giants, of being willing to look at our own, like, if only Martha King in the book could have looked at why she's doing this. What was her own secret motivation? And I think that's kind of true for all of us.
She works very hard not to find out
exactly.
Why.
And like a lot of people, she cloaks the harm that she's doing under this kind
in doing good.
In doing good. And she hides it under this kind of mask of science. And like a lot of us, you know, we commit sometimes terrible atrocities as a nation and as a society, and we tend to hide it behind these masks of
Yes, I'm just thinking the Oscars were last night and Best Picture was Oppenheimer.
Yes.
What an example
exactly.
of committing crimes in science and thinking you're benefiting
and
mankind.
Thinking you're noble and thinking you're good. And
something Oppenheimer realized later in his life and later in the movie, of course.
Yeah, and then having to wrestle with that.
Yes.
And I think actually we'd think about how much harm we would prevent if we were aware of that before we started. If we were able to step back and say, well, you know, before we get involved in this war or this other thing, you know, before I sign up for this treatment program called Holding Time, how about if we step back and look at what we're really doing and if it's a good idea?
Now, those are the human characters in the book, but I think all your books, they have non-human characters. So in this one, it's a rabbit and a polar bear, and they often have, and the butterflies, of course, and the butterfly girl, they often have a healing effect on the human characters that have been abused and abandoned, especially those characters. Mm-hmm. And you write about Dennis, Amanda's brother, who ran into the surf in Eagle Cove. He finds a rabbit who he names Bunny and becomes very attached to the rabbit and very caring. And you write, when the rabbit came out browsing along the grass, it was like the first time he lost himself, Dennis lost himself. Everything was right in the world because Dennis was not there. He was caring for Bunny. I love the way with the polar bear, not just with the rabbit, but Molly is Amanda is a caretaker for Molly, who's a polar bear at the Oregon Zoo. And in a way, a foster child, abandoned. She was separated from her mother in the Arctic, in Alaska, and her sibling. And now she's alone in the Oregon Zoo. And I guess her only friend is really Amanda. I love the way that you were able to contrast Amanda's treatment of Molly, which is very loving, and the treatment of these abandoned children at Brightwood.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, actually, I think it's the first novel I've written in which animal characters play a more prominent part.
Other than the butterflies.
Yeah, and the butterflies were more kind of thematic.
Yeah,
and these are like
metaphorical.
And these are like real animal characters. And it was interesting to me, they kind of came up as I was writing the book, and I reflected on it kind of later. And I think it's, in my personal experience, I think just as people are kind of divorced and separated from their internal motivations, a lot of us are kind of divorced and separated from the natural world. And I'm not talking about like going out for fancy, expensive vacations, because I can't afford to do that. But I get a lot out of just being out and connected to nature. I mean, I love going for walks. If you just go outside, you can see how beautiful the world is. And I think by connecting, this is Dennis. Dennis is living in the story. He's living in this horrible institution where he's literally being tortured and mistreated. But he goes out and he watches this rabbit, the wild rabbit. And as you say, he's able to lose himself and find some sense of peace and contentment. And I think for the first time starts feeling that he exists. And to me, at least, you know, that kind of connection with the natural world is so important for us in that reason. It's like we're just one creature among many. To me, and that's very soothing. I find that very comforting to think about. I'm just one creature among many.
And I think you've had that with dogs as pets. You felt that connection.
Absolutely. Yes. I have my dog Snow Dog. He's a Great Pyrenees. He's 10 now. So I'm unfortunately entering into the age of the time of preparatory grief.
That's true with all pets, right?
Isn't it?
Yeah, we have cats and there's always a point. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so
10
sad.
10 to 15 years, who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's so sad. But yeah, in the book Sleeping Giants, I really wanted to explore how we treat animals as kind of a mirror and reflection of
how we treat children.
Yeah, how we treat children, how we treat each other. And so Amanda's caring for Molly, and the polar bear's life story actually echoes in many ways Amanda and Dennis's story.
Right. Yeah. I love the parallels there. Now, there's a theme running through Sleeping Giants, and I think all your novels, we're not stuck with the families we're born into, especially the abusive ones, the dysfunctional ones. If we're lucky, we can find our own families with people who love and care for us. And there are several in the book, Amanda and Larry. Mm-hmm. 12-year-old, 9-year-old Dennis and the Brightwood custodian, Ralph, who kind of takes him in and shows some care for him, though there's not much he can do, so we think. Even Amanda and Molly, the polar bear. And you too, Renee, as the mom of three children adopted from the foster program. It's a very encouraging message for those stuck in a family that's doing them more harm than good.
Yeah.
And absolutely. That's been your story as well, huh?
Yeah. And it's so interesting that in our culture, we do still equate family with biology.
Yes.
And I always find that fascinating because particularly when I was younger and I just started my journey of adopting from foster care, I've also fostered other children for reunification. Sometimes I would get pushback from seemingly progressive, enlightened people. And they would say things like, well, aren't you afraid you won't be able to bond with your children? And I would get very curious with some of these people. What was really interesting is many of the people who would express this fear to me themselves did not have very good relationships with their own parents. So, you know, I think if you just look at it, clearly biology is no promise. Biology is not a promise of any sort of connection. You know, it's the love that we put into it. And to me, that's just a far more expansive and healthier and more hopeful way of looking at love and family. Is, you know, it's entirely the love that we put into it.
You're not doomed to always be attached to your biological family.
Yeah, exactly. And you can create, I think, families that are just as important and just as profound that are not biologically related. You know, after all, most people aren't biologically related to their spouses. You know.
Right, there's a family right there.
Yeah, there's a family right there. You kind of hope they're not biologically related.
Yes, maybe just Tennessee.
Yeah, so, you know, we don't need to be related. And I think that if you look at chosen families, you know, there's just so many ways that we can create love and be a family in this world. And in the book, I really wanted to explore some of those ways, as you mentioned, not just with people, but with animals.
Now, I want to close with something that I know is of great importance to you, and that's imagination, especially for children and adults, for that matter, who live or are living difficult lives. In The Butterfly Girl, you write, "The ones who survived captivity were the children who had learned to escape into make-believe worlds." And that reminded me, you were in the anthology Dispatches from Inaris with Ursula Le Guin, based, you know, tribute to her. And the contributors wrote stories influenced by Ursula and in praise of Ursula, to kind of homage. She was often criticized for writing works of sci-fi and fantasy. People called it simple escapism. So she answered the charge. She says, "As for the charge of escapism, what does escape mean? Escape from real life, responsibility, order, duty, piety is what the charge implies, but nobody escapes to jail. The direction of escape is toward freedom."
Oh, that's beautiful.
And I see that in when we've talked before and in your books, imagination as an escape towards freedom, towards a better life.
Yeah.
Or the prospect of a better life. You have to imagine it first before you live it,
I think. And that's something I've said in the past. I think, you know, we talk about resiliency all the time in our culture, but what is that? For me, imagination is the greatest resiliency. When you give a child an imagination, you have given them everything. Because when you have an imagination, you can imagine yourself escaping. You can imagine yourself creating a different future. You can imagine yourself getting away from perhaps a biological family that's not healthy and creating your own chosen family. So I just think imagination is something that's just overlooked when it comes to its profound ability to heal. You know, when I'm raising my kids, I focused a lot on trying to give them the imagination. It can be a very radical act for somebody that comes from some backgrounds, is to have an imagination and to feel that they have the right to dream.
And that was Dennis in the book.
Yeah.
He was hopeless, lifeless almost, until the rabbit came along and he was able to imagine a better world.
Yeah, and circling back to holding time, that's the whole point of a lot of draconian treatments and mass incarceration and a lot of the harm that we are committing as a society is we are trying to rub that out of people. We are trying to erase their hope. Basically, we need the exact opposite.
Well, I wanted to thank you, Renee, for talking with me today and also for your imagination wonderful book, Sleeping Giants, which came out of your imagination.
Thank you. I feel very lucky to be here, and I feel very lucky to do what I am doing and to have gotten to write a story like this. So thank you for having me, and thank you for anybody that might read it. I appreciate it.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Renee Denfeld, author of the new novel Sleeping Giants from HarperCollins. Renee will be launching the book at Powell City of Books in downtown Portland on Tuesday, March 26 at 7 p.m. You can find out more about Renee, the new novel, and all her work and events at reneedenfeld.com. Just a note that KBOO is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. We're in the final days of our winter membership drive, so there's no better time to show your support for the station and programming like this by becoming a member yourself or renewing your membership. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, usually from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, March 28th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.